Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship between skin color and social status? And why do we attach so much more cultural significance to the pigments in our skin than our hair or our eyes? The varying shades of human skin can be attributed in large part to the climates in which our ancestors evolved. But skin color can also have a deep impact on our social and economic well-being, particularly when it is used inappropriately as a sort of shorthand signifier of class, culture, even moral standards or intelligence. Joining us to talk about this is Nina Jablonski. She is Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at Pennsylvania State University and author of the new book, Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. Nina, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's wonderful to be with you.
So we should start, as you do in the book, with an explanation of the biological mechanisms that produce skin tones. Tell us a little bit about the processes that create this wonderful variation we have in the colors of human skin.
Well, what is beautiful about skin pigmentation is that it's completely understandable. And what we need to do is reflect on the sun, first of all. The sun is basically the reason that people's skin comes in various colors, because the intensity of the sun, especially the intensity of the ultraviolet radiation from the sun, varies from one place to another, basically being much more intense around the equator than it is closer to the poles. So people who evolved closer to the equator and whose ancestors more recently came from those equatorial climes have darker pigmentation. Their skin is imbued with high concentrations of the intensely effective natural sunscreen, melanin. Melanin pigment is just superb at protecting the skin against the damaging effects of ultraviolet radiation. As humans dispersed away from our equatorial homeland, we ended up, some of us, in very high latitude regions, others in mid-latitude regions. But what we find is that the higher the latitude, the lighter the skin. Skin actively underwent loss of pigmentation in human history as different populations adapted to very low levels of ultraviolet radiation. And the major driving force behind that was the need to continue to produce vitamin D in the skin from ultraviolet B waves. And so we have a gradient of skin pigmentation, really a beautiful even gradient from dark to light, from equator to the poles, depending on the intensity of ultraviolet radiation, especially UVB.
You have a remarkable photograph in the book of two women in Southwest Africa who live, I suppose, in the same community, but one has a German father. And that European ancestry and lighter pigmentation in her ancestry has made her far more susceptible to skin damage than her companion.
Absolutely. We see this this same experiment, of course, played out in a lot of modern contexts when people with lightly pigmented skin either vacation or live in intensely sunny places close to the equator, they suffer tremendous amounts of sun-related skin damage, which is one of the reasons that dermatologists universally all over the world now tell people to protect themselves from intense ultraviolet radiation. But especially if your ancestors came from north of the tropics or south of the tropics in the extreme high latitudes, then you really are not well adapted to be able to deal with strong sun. And what you then get is a lot of wrinkling and sun damage and a lot of skin cancer of various kinds when you reach an advanced age.
For all the importance we attach to skin color, it seems we spend very little time thinking about what a remarkable organ skin is and how vital to our overall health. Can you talk a little bit about what you've learned over the years?
Well, skin is dramatically underappreciated. We tend to take all of our bodies for granted until something breaks, but skin is particularly taken for granted. But when you think about all the things that it does. It's remarkable because it obviously provides an interface between our insides and the outside environment. But it's more than just sort of a plastic bag with no porosity. It's an incredibly selectively porous organ that allows certain things to come in. It also can provide, it is a factory for the production of vitamin D when ultraviolet radiation shines on it. But it protects us from innumerable things in our environment, whether we're talking about little scratches or chemicals or bacteria or other microbes in the environment, or excess water. I mean, we don't blow up in the bathtub like a balloon because our skin protects us from that. So it's remarkable in terms of its physiological properties.
And how might, you mentioned porosity, how might our ability to sweat have contributed to the evolution of our brains?
Oh, sweat. Beautiful sweat. I mean, it's too bad that humans have such a sort of a hate affair with sweat, because sweat really permitted us, or the evolution of a very, very efficient sweating mechanism really provided what I call, or what my colleagues and I call, a whole body cooling mechanism that allowed ultimately for keeping our brains cool under conditions of high external heat, let's say in equatorial Africa where we evolved, as well as under conditions of extreme exercise. So our lineage was a very active one. We evolved in Africa. We were heavy exercisers, running and walking vigorously in the equatorial sun, and the ability to sweat copiously helped us to keep our brains cool, and that in turn made it possible for the brain to gradually enlarge in response to other forces. So really we have our sweat to thank for our enlarged brains.
So what accounts for the variations in skin tones of some populations in very cold, sunless places, so that, for example, native Northern Europeans tend to be paler than native North Americans along the same latitude?
This is a really good question, and many people ask me about this. One of the things that we can note is that in the case of North Americans who live at far northern latitudes, the Inuit, for example, they have a very interesting lifestyle. Most of them, first of all, dispersed into the area where they now live around 10,000 years ago, and their ancestors came from North Central Asia. And so they've always had a primarily coastal lifestyle where they're eating marine mammals and oily fish, and they spend a lot of time on the snow and ice. And what we find among those people is skin that starts out being, you know, quite moderately pigmented, almost light, when we look at unexposed areas of the body. But they have a prodigious ability to develop a tan because they receive a lot of ultraviolet radiation actually reflected off the surface of the snow and ice that is in their environment. And so their skin is much different in its tanning capabilities compared to the skin of Northern Europeans. Many Northern Europeans live in areas where there is little or no snow. If you think about Northern Scotland and Northern Ireland, for instance, where we see some of the palest skin, these areas are very mild, and although they're cloudy and rainy, they are not snowy. So the background environment there is very different, and people there have very, very lightly pigmented skin with almost no ability to tan, whereas the Native Americans living even farther north but experiencing a lot of reflected ultraviolet radiation have highly tannable and quite dark skin. And just to make the picture even more interesting is the fact that the native Inuit and similar populations are highly dependent on vitamin D-rich food. Hmm. And so they're able to sort of compensate for having dark skin because they're eating such a vitamin D-rich diet.
So our understanding of the importance of vitamin D has come a long way in recent decades. Can you talk about why that is so critical and why it might, in fact, have been a major factor in terms of natural selection of people who could or could not produce enough?
Vitamin D has become one of the major buzzwords in health for the last 5 years, largely because the appreciation of vitamin D's functions has expanded. For many, many years, for decades, we've known that vitamin D is important in building a strong skeleton and that you need to have vitamin D in order to absorb calcium from your diet and build strong bones. But what has been appreciated much more strongly in the last 5 years is that vitamin D is responsible for the health of many other organ systems, especially the immune system. And so that for people who are chronically deficient in vitamin D, they are generally more susceptible to infectious diseases, whether that be a common cold or the flu or even something more severe like tuberculosis. And there is certainly intriguing and strong evidence to indicate that chronic vitamin D deficiency also contributes to the greater chance of getting certain cancers, such as breast cancer, colon cancer, and prostate cancer. So there's a lot of attention being paid to vitamin D now because it seems to be linked to so many problems that now are big public health problems in the United States and elsewhere.
Okay, Nina, I want to talk about this word race. Is there any genetic basis or biological basis for the distinctions we make between different peoples based on skin color?
The short answer is no. Definitions of races can be traced back to the middle of the 18th century, where they were deliberately constructed as categories that were mixtures of physical and cultural characteristics. Many people talk to me and they say, oh, I can recognize races. And some biologists come up to me and say, oh, well, we talk about races of plants and races of birds. Certainly there have to be races of people. Well, no. And the reason is because races of people were defined as biological and cultural categories. And these cultural assignments were made by people who were truly ignorant of the variation in human behaviors and cultures. And they made tremendous value judgments about the quality of civilization of various peoples when they made these assignments. And very significantly, races of people from the outset were placed in a hierarchy. There were some that were better and there were some that were worse, depending on these biological and cultural categories. So in short, race as we know it, applied to humans, is an entirely bankrupt concept. However, that doesn't stop people from experiencing the effects of racism. Because if someone thinks a race category is real, if they feel that they belong to either a superior or an inferior race, then they will live that expectation. They will live that definition, however fallacious it may be. So, in short, races don't exist, biologically speaking, but they exist in the minds of millions of people who experience racism.
Nina Jablonski is my guest. She's Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at Pennsylvania State University and author of the new book, Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. We'll be back in just a minute. Our number, 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with distinguished professor of anthropology at Pennsylvania State, Nina Jablonski. Her new book is called Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Emily, who wants to know about the possible skin differences, differences in skin pigments in Neanderthals, and if those differences might have been a benefit to us Homo sapiens.
A great question, Emily. Neanderthals have their DNA fully sequenced or nearly fully sequenced, and what we know from looking at one of the main pigmentation genes is that Neanderthals have a pattern of variation in this gene that indicates that many of them were lightly pigmented, and some of them may even have had red hair. And so what this means is that they, like modern Europeans living at the same latitude but much later, underwent evolution to lead to depigmented skin. Now, what's interesting about the Neanderthal depigmentation is that the genetic signature, the actual nature of the genetic mutations that caused loss of pigmentation in the Neanderthals were slightly different than the mutations that caused lack of pigmentation in modern Europeans. Hmm. And so these two events were independent in time, even though they occurred roughly in the same place. So this is fascinating from an evolutionary point of view because it means that there was a lot of natural selection pressure on populations to undergo depigmentation when they were living under conditions of low ultraviolet radiation.
So we had this outward migration from the first evolution of modern humans in Africa to other parts of the world. At what point did migration begin to bring people together who had evolved noticeably different skin tones?
Well, really, we see this happening, Chris, after the rise of agriculture, when we begin to see large population centers developing as the result of domestication of plants and then animals. And so the first real big contact that we see is actually along the Nile River, because the Nile was such and has been such a fertile area for plant growth for thousands of years. We see in the earliest trade along the Nile peoples of vastly different skin tones coming in contact with one another between 7,000 and 4,000 years ago and then, you know, right up to the present time. And what's so important about this contact is that it was routine trading contact for the most part. There were lots of diplomatic ties. There were lots of trades going up and down the river. And basically, people just dealt with one another as other people, as people with equal levels of civilization and equal levels of other cultural development. And they depicted one another differently. We see in the art along the Nile that they recognized that different skin colors obtained in different populations, but they didn't treat one another differently because of it. And so in these early patterns of contact that we see in Egypt and later around the Circum-Mediterranean, we see people recognizing that differences exist, but prejudice, as we know it today, based on color, did not exist. Hmm. What we see is that populations, wherever they're found, tend to favor people of their own culture, regardless of what color the people are. And so if they share a similar cultural background and language, they're generally considered to be okay. Outsiders are perhaps not okay in the first instance. But for the most part, trading contacts in antiquity were among equals, and people were considered skin color was not an essential regulator of social interaction.
And that would clearly belie the argument that some people have made in recent years that looking even at populations where most people have darker skin, there seems to be a preference, a cultural preference for lighter skin, some kinds of special privileges to lighter skin people. That would seem to belie the idea that this is somehow an inherent bias.
That's right. And what we, I'll get to the lighter skin preference in just a moment, but what's, you know, quite clear, especially if we go back to the Egyptian example, is that, you know, people with lighter or darker skin were considered to be every bit equal in their abilities, in their aptitudes, in their motivations, in their levels of culture. And that is very important. Now, what's interesting in the preference for skin, for light skin tones, is that we see within any particular culture, especially within long-standing agricultural cultures, we do see preference for lighter skin tones. This appears to be because lighter skin tones are associated with freedom from outdoor toil and freedom from having to work in the fields. And so it's quite different from sort of a blind color prejudice. Rather, it's based on if you can afford to be inside all the time and have light skin, then you must, of course, be better off. And, for instance, in China, throughout, well, actually for thousands of years, women were considered to be highly desirable if they were extremely pale, which demonstrated that they didn't have to toil outside. Similarly, in Japan, Korea, and in India, the same thing obtained. And so we see this preference for very pale skin developing in very, very densely populated agricultural societies where people did have to work very hard in the fields, and if you didn't, that meant you were very well off.
And what's so funny is that that's sort of the direct opposite of the cultural preference that arose in the middle part of the last century, where if you had money for leisure time, you had the time to lie around outside the pool and get tanner if you had light skin.
Absolutely. And so what we saw in the 20th century is almost a complete turnaround, because at the beginning of the 20th century, at least in most of Europe and the Americas, the premium was on porcelain skin. Even in East Asia, this was definitely the preference for porcelain skin, very, very clear, luminous skin with hardly, you know, a blemish on it or any sign of a tan. And then we see a very interesting thing happening. Firstly, people start using the sun as therapy for tuberculosis. So sun starts to be used in sanatoria in Switzerland and elsewhere to help people recover from tuberculosis. A little bit later, in the mid-20th century, we see a few celebrities, notably Coco Chanel beginning in the 1930s, who were outside. They developed a tan when they were outside sailing or casually walking around, and they were not hesitant to have themselves be photographed with the tan. And as soon as these images started to circulate, then tanning somehow became socially acceptable. And what's really important here, Chris, is that it was the circulation of images that made it okay. Before then, people were beginning to look at fashion magazines, but things like fashion magazines really came into their own in the mid-20th century. And when images of tanned celebrities started to be circulated widely, and women could see that it was actually glamorous to have a tan and a mark of leisure and higher status to be tanned, then the tables turned completely, and the porcelain complexion sort of went out the window overnight, which isn't to say that it was completely devalued because it remained important in some circles, but there's no doubt that through the middle of the 20th century and into the later 20th century, tans were the thing, and they remain the thing in many parts of South America and Central America, and even in parts of Europe and North America still.
But sadly, that new preference for tan skin hasn't really done very much to eliminate racism, because we think of race as something separate than skin color, even.
Absolutely. And what's so interesting now, when you go to a tanning parlor in many parts of the United States, you'll find that there'll be a consultant there who will help you determine, you know, how much UV tan and sunless tanning agent you should have to you know, apply to your skin or that you want to expose yourself to, because you want just enough to look healthy and bronzed, but not so much to look naturally darkly pigmented.
Hmm.
You know, so there's this really fine social calculus that goes into tanning, because you don't want to be too dark, because that would associate you with the member of a group that is not considered to be as prominent or superior. And this is really a tragedy that we still very much retain discrimination in many parts of the United States against naturally darkly pigmented people. And the darker the pigment, the more discrimination is felt.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with Nina Jablonski about her new book, Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. Let's go on the phone now to Angie in Plano. Hi, Angie.
Oh, hi. Thank you, Chris, for bringing this guest up. I am really interested in that subject, and I thank your guest for writing that book, and I can't wait to get my hands on that. I just wanted to say that, you know, growing up, being Hispanic and growing up in the 60s and 70s, it was very hard to be Hispanic in the DFW area. And, you know, I was at school with mostly white kids. I believe I was the only Hispanic kid at school at the time. And it was so hard. And until the 80s, when we started to get Asian students, Chinese students, and we had already some Middle Eastern students that were coming in the late 70s, but 80s is when, you know, a big immigration influx of Asian students came. And they're, you know, naturally dark, too. So that kind of made it okay, I think, because they were considered, you know, very intelligent. So, and then later on, having also people from India come here to go to school, that made it even better for me, because then I wasn't the only one that was dark skin. Hmm. I didn't stand out so much. And then we had a whole bunch of people. Now it's become, you know, more normal to have people different variations of skin color. And I don't know if you're Miss
Jablonski, Nina.
Mm-hmm. Has seen this article a couple of years ago, came out that actually with the white skin, they've done the research and says it's actually a genetic defect. That's the reason that's how they came about.
Well, let's hear about that. What do you want to respond to that,
yeah.
Nina?
Well, Angie, firstly, you know, I sympathize very much with your situation, because I was one of the more darkly pigmented kids in my school in upstate New York, and it was, you know, it's hard, especially when you have kids around you who really don't know any better, and they just have, you know, sort of strange ideas that they've heard from their relatives or whatever about, you know, what skin color is better than others. And so now that people are being exposed to a variety of different skin tones, especially if they live in a city or if they simply watch the media, they can see how people of every skin tone can aspire to and establish high reputations at whatever they want to turn their attention to. So this is really good. But that doesn't diminish the damage or the feelings that you had when you were growing up. So what is good is that we now can recognize that people of all skin pigmentations can achieve a high level, whatever they turn their attention to. And very importantly, skin pigmentation genes are not, for the most part, connected to genes for other traits. So there aren't blocks of genes that are associated with everything in a particular group. Skin pigmentation and traits related to the appearance of your eyes or the length of your legs are all controlled by separate genes. Now, getting to your second question about white pigmentation or pale skin being a defect, I really wouldn't want to call it a defect. What it is it's a result of genetic changes or mutations that favored depigmentation under conditions of low solar radiation, specifically low UV. And so one can think of all the genetic changes that we have experienced in our species history as being these mutations that have been acted upon by natural selection, and some of them have disappeared, but others have become widely adopted because they have helped us survive and reproduce successfully under particular environmental conditions. So I think it's a mistake to think of any extreme of pigmentation as being a defect, but rather an adaptation to circumstances brought about by a genetic mutation.
Nina Jablonski is with us. She's Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at Pennsylvania State University and author of Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Nina Jablonski. She's Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at Pennsylvania State University and author of the new book Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Chris, Nina, who writes, while you're correct that there's no clinical evidence of a known genetic difference between the races, there are biological differences between the races. An example is sickle cell anemia. Can you give us some perspective on that? My understanding is that sickle cell anemia that Chris writes about is more common in people of African heritage.
That's right. And it's a very important point to raise. Chris notes that sickle cell anemia is a racial trait. But actually, when we look at sickle cell anemia and similar traits, such as thalassemia that afflicts Mediterranean populations, these traits are all functionally related to one another in that they allow or they give populations or people who have these traits effective immunity from malaria. So people who carry one copy of the sickle cell gene or one copy of the thalassemia gene actually are resistant to malaria. So what we find is that traits like the sickle cell trait have evolved repeatedly in especially agricultural areas where people have been in close proximity to malarial mosquitoes. And so so the sickle cell trait is simply one of many traits that we find that that provides immunity to malaria in similar kinds of populations. Sickle cell trait is more common in West and Central African peoples, but the thalassemia trait, and actually there are several different kinds of thalassemias, are found throughout the Circum-Mediterranean and into South Asia. So these traits have evolved multiple times in many different populations.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Steve on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
Yes, my question will be real quick. I read an article from, it's an albino organization that explains albinism, and it said that white skin, although your guest eloquently spoke about environmental factors, there is a genetic component to white skin, and also at the website, it talked about that there is a genetic defect, and it's OCA1 through OCA4 that causes that skin condition. It also said that the myth about albinism and albinos, that they're having red eyes, is just that, a myth. You can have brown eyes and predominantly blue eyes. Could she address OCA genetic disorder, please?
Thanks for your call.
Yes, certainly. Albinism is a really important and interesting trait, which needs to be distinguished from normal light pigmentation. Because if we look throughout much of the northern hemisphere, for instance, we find people with light pigmentation who are not sufferers of albinism. Albinism, as you rightly point out, is caused by a series of different genetic mutations that lead to a complete absence of pigmentation in the skin, as well as, depending on the type of albinism, no pigmentation in the iris of the eye or in the hair. And albinism is a very serious problem because it renders people much more susceptible to damage from the sun's rays. And so they not only can experience much more skin cancer, they can also experience severe damage to their eyes. And so blindness is one problem that many people with albinism can face if they don't wear good sunglasses. Albinism is a trait that occurs as a result of these mutations at the, your listener points out, at the OCA 1 through 4 loci. And they're present, or albinism occurs in about 1 in 4,000 to 1 in every 10,000 live births. And it does appear to be more common in African populations. And the reason for this is still not entirely clear, why this genetic mutation is carried through and really hasn't gone to or hasn't been eliminated. So the issue is that different levels of pigmentation are caused by different genetic changes. All of these changes can be labeled mutations, but in the case of albinism, these we can consider to be quite harmful mutations, whereas many of the other mutations that led to the original evolution of dark pigmentation or the original evolution of depigmented skin in Asians and Europeans would be considered positive mutations.
You know, I want to go back to something you said earlier, Nina, that many people feel like they can look at someone and sort of understand what that person's race might be. And the introduction of genetic sequencing and how that has sort of turned a lot of that upside down. My own children had their DNA tested and have some Asian ancestry that is not apparent in looking at them. No one knows the family history. And it really does call into question our assumptions about what we know about our own selves.
Absolutely, because we do tend to label ourselves and label each other according to this sort of immediate gestalt. Oh, I know, you know, so-and-so, you know, must be from Korea or must be from Central Africa or wherever. And what is wonderful about genetic testing is that often what is revealed is a wonderful hybrid ancestry to most everyone. People turn out to have, as your children found out, you know, Asian ancestry. Who knows exactly what grandparent it was attached to? Many, many people in the United States find out that they have African American and Native American ancestry, and this is superb. The more that people can find out the extent to which we are all hybrids and that we're all the result of complex genetic mixtures, the less hung up we will be about our genetic ancestry. This won't stop us from, sadly, from discriminating according to various things. I mean, people will always find things that they can be prejudiced about, but it can reduce the amount of discrimination that we feel toward one another or heap on others as a result of perceived differences in appearance.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Kristen in Dallas. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. I actually was wondering what Ms. Sablonski knew or how she felt about something I've read a couple of times and I actually saw as part of a movie that I've not been able to find since, where people are, I guess some scientists are hypothesizing that for the extreme future of our species, that as a result of several factors, including our own voluntary movement around the planet and migration around the planet, that our skin tones will become more homogenized and get closer to, for lack of a better way of describing it, a kind of tanned, you know, kind of almost latte toned skin. And I wonder if she had ever heard of that and if she had her thoughts on that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Kristen.
Yeah, Kristen, yes, I certainly have. And what we see is in most big cities, just what you are describing, because as people come together from all different parts of the world and with various skin tones and they share cultures, they find things in common, they have children together, and what we see, especially in the cities that have been diverse for the longest periods of time, like New York City, San Francisco, Chicago, we see incredible variations in skin tone and genetic background, so that the future, at least for the big cities in the world, is an increasing homogenization of skin tone and other features. But we will continue to have, in more remote places and rural places throughout the world, more enclaves of people who look like their ancestors did. So if you go to isolated villages in parts of Europe or isolated villages in Asia or Africa, you will see people who look much more like their ancestors did 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. And those places that are less well-traveled or to which people where it's much harder for people to come into contact with one another, will continue to be more genetically isolated and will look more homogeneous. So the long and short of it is our cities will become tanner, and the rest of the world will continue to be a beautiful patchwork quilt.
What role do the media play in establishing not only the sort of acceptability of a variation of a variety of skin tones, but also the idea that every skin color can be beautiful?
Well, I think one of the important things is to recognize that that there is no, that from a biological perspective, there is no better skin tone. Everyone's skin tone, when we look at the ancestry of it, is adapted to a particular set of environmental conditions. And so it's the product of evolution, and that's really interesting in itself. So that's one important thing. But the second important thing comes from education, that skin tone isn't related to other aspects of a person's makeup or to their behavior or their personality or to the culture that they may share. So skin tone is simply something that reflects someone's ancestry and that it's beautiful and interesting, but the idea of assigning a cultural value to it is simply fallacious and harmful. And I think the more that we can do to teach our children about this, the better off we'll all be.
Has it been your experience that when you're teaching these ideas, say, to undergrads that you may come in contact with, that they have less trouble accepting it as reality than older generations of Americans in particular?
Absolutely. The younger the audience, the more they get it. Basically, a lot of the things that middle-aged people in the United States especially are still hung up about are not problems for the college-age population or for the high school or middle school population, because younger people are used to having lots of friends who describe themselves as mixed race, who have a very sort of mixed identity and a modern identity. So I think partly we will grow out of this as a society, but we shouldn't be complacent because there are always influences that tend to bring us back to these themes of durable inequality, and we have to resist those, and we have to cultivate this more youthful, accepting attitude of everyone being a mixed-race person.
So we can look forward to the future, but we ought not to forget our past.
That's right. And also, we must not be complacent. We can't, you know, assume that just because more people are thinking about mixed race that we live in a post-racial society. There's certainly a lot of deep-seated and hidden racism that we still have to deal with in this country.
And do you, I guess the last thing I want to ask is whether you think that public policy needs to be part of this formula.
It has to be absolutely part of this formula because the motivation to, for instance, bring about changes in our educational system so that kids know more about skin color and race. The motivation from this has to come from the top. So public policy must be a part of this. It cannot be all a grassroots move. So, yes, we need our policymakers to embrace this. We need them to don't want to say get their heads from out of the sand, but simply to recognize that we're not in a post-racial world. We need to actively work toward social equality for all Americans, and
Nina,
that takes work.
Nina Jablonski's new book is Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. Nina, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Check out that podcast free at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.